Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. What causes lunar dust? That is our topic in episode 43. Meteoroids are particles of rock and ice. Most are in orbit around the Sun. Many are leftover fragments of comets. They often travel in groups. When the Earth travels through one of these groups, we get a meteor shower. When they enter our atmosphere, most vaporize as what we call a shooting star. When they hit the Moon, then it's wham, a high-speed impact. If they hit a permanently shadowed region, a PSR, then they can throw out volatiles into space. The rate at which this happens can have implications for ISRU, that is, in-situ resource utilization by future astronauts. One spacecraft that is dedicated to studying how much dust and volatiles are kicked up off the Moon was LADEE. This was the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, which was launched in 2013 and orbited the Moon for 7 months. Having taken note of the LADEE results, Mihaly Horanyi of the University of Colorado wants to set up a series of lunar environmental monitoring stations.
So this talk is about an instrument, the Lunar Meteoroid Monitor. So typically we discuss meteorites in two groups, showers and the sporadic background. And the only difference is that the sporadic background is particles that forgot their parent bodies. As long as dust particles orbit is similar to the parent body, they will show up as streams and meteor showers. Maybe some of you had a chance to go out, you know, last week and look for the Perseids. They come and hit the Earth and deliver cosmic material, cosmic dust, about or on the order of 100 tons per day. If you just scale it to the Moon, that's about 5 tons per day of incoming dust that is continuously reworking or gardening the lunar surface. Of course, at Earth, you know, because we have an atmosphere, these incoming dust particles, most of them will not reach the surface, but we can observe them as shooting stars visually, or you could also use radar meteor stations to monitor the speed, direction. But the precise knowledge of how much dust, what's the size and speed distribution after many decades of ground-based observation still escapes us. Of course, the Moon does not have an atmosphere. So the incoming, the same flux that reaches the Earth, that would directly reach the surface of the Moon and generates secondary particles, ejecta particles. The vast majority of them would have speeds below escape speed. So they follow kind of ballistic orbits. They jump up and eventually fall back down to the surface. We had an incredible mission not so long ago, 2013, 2014, the LADEE mission. So the top right is the trajectories. It started out at 200 kilometers above the surface, then dropped down to between 100 and 50 and so on. And it is an impact ionization dust detector. So the dust particle comes in, hits a target, generates a puff of plasma that is separated by an electric field and record the electrons and the ion signals, and that would tell us the size of the dust particle. The typical speeds of a dust with respect to the lunar surface is much, much smaller than the spacecraft. The spacecraft was going 1.7 kilometers per second, as opposed to the dust particles. Most of them will be recorded at their turning point. So the relative motion with respect to the moon is just a few or tens of meters per second. The daily average impact rate of particles once per minute, even as high as 200 kilometers above the surface, the little 100 square centimeter effective dust detector was hit once per minute. If you were looking for bigger particles, like 0.7 micron or so in radii, then you had to wait 10 minutes between impacts. Another curious information on this plot is during, you know, the Northern Taurids, the Geminids, the Quadrantids, and so forth, these are the meteor showers where you see the dust cloud. The dust cloud engulfing the entire moon was enhanced. These are much higher speed, short duration, several days worth of events when the impact rate was enhanced during these periods. So these are the special periods, so the Northern Taurids, the Geminids. For a couple of days, the impact rate was certainly enhanced, and we can recognize the meteor showers through their effect of the production of the ejecta cloud. So why do you care? I mean, throughout this session, you're worried about the surface, and other parts of this meeting is about volatiles and so forth. Because, you know, as far as dust goes, there is no permanently shadowed region, regardless where you are. Maybe up towards the poles when there is a hope that volatiles will accumulate and we could go to these regions and use them for ISRU, find resources, volatiles, possibly water. As far as dust impacts go, these regions are not protected. So dust impacts in general, of course, could release volatiles. They could migrate nevertheless, but then they remain exposed to impacts. They can deliver dust and bury them, or through ejecta production, remove them. And with all honesty, we really don't have a good model. What is the net production or loss, transport, and input to the permanently shadowed region? And how does dust impacts affect what is there to be worked with for ISRU, for example? So these issues that we need to learn the dust impact environment of the moon were recognized very early on. And this was the lunar ejecta and meteorite experiment left behind Apollo 17 and worked for 30 lunations or so. But dust itself made the LEAM measurements complicated because this instrument overheated during the day. So this transition from day to night, night to day, even though it is frequently used as proof of electrostatic transport and so forth. So to answer, you know, back to the LEAM original Apollo 17 issues or the Artemis issues, you would like to monitor what's coming to the surface, what's the size and the speed distribution. So it turns out that the fluxes are relatively modest, so you need a large surface area, and the type of instruments that you could use would employ thin plastic films. PVDF, polyvinylidene fluoride films, have been used as dust detectors. They are permanently polarized, and when the particle excavates a crater, they generate an electrical signal. You could do two of these layers, one below the other, so the penetrating particles then will impact the second layer, and you could measure the time of flight and get the charge that they generate, and the speed that you measure allows you to figure out the mass and the speed of the incoming particles. As a summary, these are the things you will have to worry about when you design an instrument like this. You have to have a deployable structure because you cannot put on a small spacecraft or a bigger spacecraft, a large surface area dust instrument. If you there are arguments that it would be really good to survive the lunar night. So clearly, in that case, low-power electronics is a key. You have to have very low power consumption, so you would survive the lunar night, as opposed to the difficulty of surviving the lunar day when things get very hot. You have to have good thermal control, that these films remain permanently polarized and they can be used even when the temperature goes and swings from minus 170 to plus 120 from night to day. But in principle, you could envision that an instrument like this could be deployed as part of a lunar environmental monitoring stations, and arguments are around that we could build rovers that would have an expected lifetime well over 2 years, safely surviving the temperature swings from day and night. Thank you.
A year before that 2021 talk, Mihaly Horanyi gave an overview of the orbital observations of lunar dust.
As you might recall, the Earth is continually bombarded by 100 or 150 tons of interplanetary dust every day. They come in forms of meteor showers or small particles that decoupled from their original source and form the sporadic meteoroid background. Scaling it to the moon, about 5 to 15 tons of interplanetary high-speed particles, 15 to 20 kilometers per sec impact speeds, will bombard the moon. It has no atmosphere, so as opposed to the Earth, where you could enjoy shooting stars, if you are on the moon, they are directly hitting to the surface and generating plumes of dust, typically 200, 300, 400 meters per sec, outgoing small particles that a tiny fraction of that is escaping. The majority of that is falling back onto the moon. And this is the gardening and the resurfacing and the one of the primary processes responsible of shaping the characteristics of the regolith and also possibly contributing to forming the lunar atmosphere. The mission LADEE, Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, was a short duration, beautiful mission, 2013-2014. It was orbiting initially about the height of 200 kilometer and then dropped down to 100 and furthest away down to 50, 10, a couple kilometers above the surface, eventually crashing into the surface in April of 2014. It carried this small dust instrument, LDEX. An incoming dust particle generates a plasma puff as it hits the target, about 100 square centimeter. Electrons and ions are collected separately. They are separated by an electric field. And those two signals allows us to tell you how big the incoming particle was. Even at 200 kilometer height, this instrument was hit at least once per minute with tiny dust particles coming from the surface. This is all the data we collected, the impact rate of particles as small as 0.3 micron in radius and bigger, hitting this instrument once per minute, or bigger particles, which is 0.7 micron in radius. On average, you had to wait 10 minutes to have a hit. So now that tells you something interesting, because the structure of a plume allows you to project it back where it came from the surface. Imagine that you would fly over permanently shadowed regions. I have to remind you that as far as dust, interplanetary dust is concerned, nothing is shadowed. It is coming at all times, at all places. So imagine that you would fly over a permanently shadowed region with a dust instrument. You would certainly be able to look into these regions using dust. And when I mean look into that, you could actually develop an instrument, and we have these in our labs, that in addition, just to tell you the size of a dust particle, it can break the impact generated plasma cloud into a time of flight system and tell you the composition of the particle. I would like to add, of course, that we don't really know the meteoroid flux, especially to polar regions, and what exactly are its effects. Is it delivering volatiles? Is it actually removing volatiles? Or how does it contribute to the budget of resources that you might consider for ISRU in permanently shadowed regions? To close that knowledge gap, you could consider a polar orbiting spacecraft,
the dust composition analyzer, and the large area dust flux monitor somewhere on the surface to tell you what hits the surface, what speed, what size distribution, possibly what composition. You know, the moon, as any other airless body or bodies with atmospheres, are continuously bombarded by micrometeorites. In response, the moon is engulfed in a permanently present dust exosphere. It is changing with time and location. The ejecta particles are samples from the surface and provide an opportunity to map the surface composition from orbit and identify possibly regions that are high value for ISRU. Finally, if you were to consider a large area dust influx monitor on the lunar surface, that might help to resolve how to best protect the long-term presence of humans and machines on the surface. Thank you.
Mihaly Horanyi from the University of Colorado in Boulder. As already described, the lunar regolith consists of tiny, sharp-edged fragments of rock and glasses, the result of billions of years' bombardment by asteroids and meteorites. Add to this the impact of the electrons and protons of the solar wind, and it is no surprise that the regolith is well and truly space-weathered. In August of 2020, Jeffrey Gillis Davis of St. Louis, Washington University, described the regolith.
All right. So today I'm going to give an overview of space weathering and give a little bit of compare and contrast with what we know from our samples that we've collected at the equator to those that might be at the poles and are detected by remote sensing and show a difference in some physical characters than what we see at the equator. So as a quick review, we know space weathering as a phenomena based through TEM studies, magnetic studies, geochemical, spectral data of lunar regolith samples. However, all these samples are a little bit biased towards revealing a story about space weathering that, while accurate for the environment in which they were collected, are not directly applicable to other settings, like Dave was talking about in magnetic squirrels, or like I'll be discussing for the lunar polar regions. Did a very unhappy mood being assaulted by different forms of matter that deliver energy over multiple orders of magnitude and flux. This complex interplay of matter and energy are what we collectively know as space weathering. And the two dominant forms of space weathering are the solar wind, which is predominantly hydrogen, but also helium, carbon, nitrogen, and micrometeorite bombardment. The solar wind causes particle implantation, which implants hydrogen mostly into lunar grains, but it also leads to erosion and vaporization, which is caused by sputtering from the high impact energy of the charged particles. And micrometeorites also do melting, comminution, and agglutination of the soil. If we take a look at soil, you can see it's a very fine mixture of mineral fragments, rock fragments, and different types of glasses. What we can see is, you know, basaltic mineral fragments, as well as volcanic glasses and impact glass in the form of spherules and glass fragments. And these can be distinguished by size, but mostly by chemistry. Delano 86 has different chemical parameters for differentiating between those two types of glasses. And then there is agglutinate glass. It looks basically like black gum that's been dropped into a black sand beach in Hawaii. And agglutinates reflect the chemistry of the bulk soil in which they are found, pretty much. With the difference being that in mare soils, the agglutinates tend to be a little bit enriched in aluminum and depleted in iron compared to the less than 45 micron soil component. And in highlands, it's just the opposite. They typically contain less aluminum and more iron than the bulk regolith. Where do the components come from? So in any scoop of soil, much of it comes from the nearby neighborhood, both laterally and underlying bedrock. Some of it contains from the local region, and then some comes from a very broad surroundings. And that little block of plage or feldspar rich material in the sample is what led John to, you know, be able to come up with the lunar magma ocean hypothesis without, you know, actually landing in the highlands. So even a small scoop of soil can tell you a lot about the whole moon. So the particle range is enormous, as we heard earlier. It goes from boulders to micron size. The average size is about 40 to 70 microns. The mass, by mass of a sieve sample, the sample tends to be about that 40 to 70 microns. And the regolith thickness covers everything, so there's no bedrock that Apollo samples come from. And it varies from about 1 meter in some of the newest, youngest mare to over 10 to maybe even 15 meters in the lunar highlands. When we look at these samples brought back in TEM, Lindsay Keller and McKay, they classified rims into four types. So it's important that we understand the regolith because that's where all our samples were collected from. The geophysical measurements were placed on the regolith. It's where the hardware make contact. It's the astronauts where they traverse and rovers travel. And it serves as a basis for our comparative planetology when we're studying Mercury and asteroids or other airless bodies in the Jovian system. We can use remote sensing. One of the powers is to take it from where we have samples at the equator and look at the chemistry, mineralogy, and physical properties of the places where we haven't sampled, like the poles. And you can see the different types of remote sensing look at the regolith to different depths, from microns to tens of meters. And then here is where we see and start to get an idea that the polar regolith is different than the equatorial regolith. We see from studies by Hemingway and Lucy and Lemelin that the LOLA reflectance, the normal albedo in the equator, is actually darker than at the polar regions, and also Clementine reflectance of Maria in the equatorial regions are slightly darker than Maria closer to the polar regions. Gladstone in the PSR show that the FUV or the far UV reflectance shows that the upper layer has a lot higher porosity than what we see at the equator. And this is also confirmed by Diviner data and even the LCROSS impact data. So putting that together, my top questions were, you know, what is the dominant form of space weathering on the moon? Those LOLA data are usually held to be solar wind as the dominant form. But what we see in the samples is that agglutinants are, you know, the primary cause for darkening. So to me, as a sample person, it would suggest that something with agglutinants is changing between the equator and the poles, and that something could be related actually to micrometeorite bombardment. Other questions are, how do the local environments, such as temperature, presence of volatiles, and the like, actually affect space weathering? Another one I had is actually knowing the grain size distribution of the less than 20 microns. We don't know that very well because it actually matters on how you sieve the data, or sieve the samples, and different sieving techniques come up with different answers. And with that, I'll stop.
From Washington University in St. Louis, that was Jeffrey Gillis Davis. With so much dust on the lunar surface, it would be no surprise that it will have a major impact on human exploration. Joelle Levine is research professor in applied science at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg. He outlines the problem.
I want to start the talk on lunar dust and its impact on human exploration with two quotes. And I think these two quotes are very important because they talk about an important issue. This is from Gene Cernan, one of the last two humans to walk on the moon on Apollo 7. Quote, "I think dust is probably one of the greatest inhibitors to a nominal operation on the moon. I think we can overcome other physiological or physical or mechanical problems, except dust. One of the most aggravating, restricting facets of lunar dust exploration is the dust and its adherence to everything, no matter what kind of material, whether it be skin, suit material, metal, no matter what it be, and its restrictive friction-like action to everything it gets on. And this problem continues once we leave the surface of the moon. This is from Alan Bean. After Apollo 12 astronaut Alan Bean, after lunar liftoff, a great quantity of dust floated free within the cabin. This dust made breathing without the helmet difficult, and enough particles were present in the cabin atmosphere to affect our vision. The use of a WISP room prior to ingress would probably not be satisfactory in solving the dust problem, because the dust tends to rub deeper into the garment rather than to brush it off. The impact of dust on human exploration of the moon, on the astronauts, their equipment, and so on, has been the title of several studies. And let me refer to Jim Geyer's study, which is a NASA technical memorandum. Jim relates lunar dust to 9 different kinds of problems. Vision obscuration. You remember on Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong had some difficulty because the rocket exhausts were causing so much dust to be put into the thin lunar atmosphere that he had trouble seeing the surface. Then there's false instrument readings, dust coating and contamination, loss of traction, clogging of mechanisms, abrasion. In fact, the lunar dust was so abrasive that had the Apollo astronauts wanted to go on an additional EVA, the spacesuits may not have been capable of protecting them. That's how much abrasion there was on the suit. Thermal control problems, failures of seals, and inhalation and irritation. During the debriefings, all of the astronaut debriefings, there are several hundred detailed references to the impact of dust on the astronauts and their equipment and the mission, and that's summarized in Jim Geyer's paper. Some key questions that need investigation. What are the particle size distribution, mineralogy / chemical composition, and possible toxicity of lunar dust, especially for the particles less than 50 microns? Second, what processes / mechanisms control the transport / dynamics of lunar surface dust? Number three, what are the electrical and magnetic properties of lunar dust? And number four, what techniques / technologies are needed to reduce / mitigate lunar dust impacts on the astronauts, their equipment, habitats, and spacecraft? So these were some of the key problems that appeared in the literature. So I just want to summarize that lunar dust, in addition to being an interesting scientific area to study, has some very, very significant impacts on human exploration. And as we're preparing for the second round of human exploration of Mars, we have to really get serious about solving the problems of dust mitigation and reduction. Thank you.